Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Hussein Ibish, Vice Chair of the Progressive Muslim Union, who assesses the January 30th Iraqi election and what it may mean for the future of Iraq and the insurgency fighting to end U.S. occupation. Historian Howard Zinn, who takes a look at the track record of establishing democracies under military occupations throughout history. And Art Laffin, a lifelong pacifist and activist with the Catholic Worker Movement, who explains his opposition to the death penalty despite having lost his brother to murder. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In mid-June 2002, John Walker Lind, dubbed the American Taliban by the U.S. media, was set to go to a court hearing on suppression of evidence. But Pentagon lawyers wanted to stop the hearing in its tracks. They were afraid that Lind and his legal team would expose the abusive treatment of prisoners approved for the Bush War on Terror that later exploded into the Abu Ghraib scandal in Iraq. According to The Nation magazine, Lind was prepared to talk in open court about the alleged torture he had endured by his American captors. Federal District Court Judge T.S. Ellis was ready to let Lind's lawyers put active military officers and Guantanamo detainees on the stand to detail the abusive tactics used on Lind. The U.S. Justice Department, under the leadership of Michael Chertoff, then head of the department's criminal division and now nominee to run the Department of Homeland Security, quickly offered Lind's lawyers a deal. The government would drop the terrorism charges in exchange for a guilty plea to aiding an enemy of the United States in carrying a gun. Lind also agreed to a 20-year jail sentence. According to Lind's lawyer, George Harris, Chertoff tacked on a new demand that Lind had to sign a statement that he was not mistreated intentionally by U.S. guards and waived any right to sue on the basis that he was mistreated or tortured. Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights called Chertoff's tactics outrageous. As he explained to The Nation magazine, it is off the charts in terms of morality and should be a line of questioning for Chertoff's confirmation hearing. However, such tough questions may never be asked. A number of key Senate Democrats have already endorsed Chertoff to head the Department of Homeland Security. Once again, Europe and the Bush administration are going in opposite directions. This time, the disagreement is over development aid to poor nations in the wake of the massive tsunami in the Indian Ocean. Speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, British Prime Minister Tony Blair called massive poverty in Africa a scar on the conscience of the world. Blair, who chairs the G7 group of industrialized nations in 2005, wants to place emphasis on global poverty, climate change, and HIV/AIDS. In addition, Blair's finance chief, Gordon Brown, promised to present a plan for 100% debt relief to poor nations. It was a call that was endorsed by German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder. French President Jacques Chirac also proposed a tax on currency flows to fight global AIDS. Meanwhile, the Bush administration is cutting back on its funding allocation to the United Nations Millennium Goals that aim to cut global poverty in half by 2015. In mid-January, the administration reduced its pledge for the coming year from $5 billion to $3 billion. So far, Congress has only agreed to pay $2.5 billion to meet the UN Millennium Goals, just 40% of what President Bush promised at a summit in Monterrey, Mexico. The controversial Central American Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA, cleared its first hurdle in late December when the Parliament of El Salvador ratified the treaty. In response, critics such as labor unions and civil society groups say the fight over CAFTA is far from over. The Free Trade Agreement was signed in late 2003 and early 2004 by the Bush administration and five Central American governments. According to the Interpress Service, fair trade activists say farmers will be the first to suffer from CAFTA and open markets because they have little subsidies to protect them from massive agriculture and industrial imports. More than half of Central America's 37 million people live below the poverty line. The Bush administration has not yet set a date to present CAFTA to the U.S. Senate for its approval. Meanwhile, a massive corruption scandal in Costa Rica entangling two former presidents, Miguel Rodriguez, who stepped down in 2002, and Rafael Calderón, who held power in the early 1990s, could stop the momentum behind CAFTA. The scandal that broke in September and October implicates Rodriguez for taking kickbacks from the French telecom giant Alcatel, while Calderón was alleged to have made illegal commissions from the same French company. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
The January 30th Iraq election, which produced a higher turnout among Shia and Kurdish voters than expected, prompted President Bush and his supporters to declare the vote a triumph of democracy and a defeat for insurgents who had launched attacks to disrupt the ballot. Supporters of the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq were quick to declare the election a vindication of their war policy, although the democratization of Iraq was clearly not the original justification for the conflict. In a televised address to the nation shortly after the election, the president said, quote, "The people of Iraq have spoken to the world, and the world is hearing the voice of freedom from the center of the Middle East," end quote. The 275-member Transitional National Assembly is to draft a constitution, with a referendum on that document to take place in October. But because many in the Sunni minority of Iraq's population either boycotted the election or stayed away from the polls due to threats of violence, there is concern that a new government that will be dominated by Shiite political parties could set off interreligious conflicts or a civil war. There is also concern in the region and among policymakers in Washington that a new Shiite government could move toward establishing an Islamic fundamentalist theocracy allied with Iran. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Hussein Ibish, vice chair of the Progressive Muslim Union, who assesses the January 30th Iraqi election and what it may mean for the future of Iraq and the insurgency fighting to end the U.S. military occupation.
This was a good day, and it's the first good day in a long time. Maybe it's really the first good thing to happen since the occupation began, even in its own fairly limited way. Ultimately, obviously, one election does not create a democracy, and that's the same thing that people who are not friendly to contemporary Arab politics have said about every election that's been held, and every attempt to indigenously reform Middle Eastern political systems. However, I think the first thing to note is that the reason for the triumphalism and the reason that, that this is such a huge deal is that this is a substitute. This business about democratizing Iraq really is something of an afterthought. The reason that we were all told the United States was going to war was to disarm Iraq and Saddam Hussein from weapons of mass destruction, specifically chemical, possibly biological weapons, of which there proved to be none. So in other words, the president's triumphal address on Sunday, congratulating the Iraqis and what have you, is a poor substitute for the end of what he began by saying was, and I quote him, the mission to disarm Saddam Hussein has begun. I mean, that's what he said on the eve of war. That was his announcement that the war had begun. Having said that, I do think, that one can be too cynical, and one shouldn't be. I think this was a real victory for people in Iraq who've been pushing for democratization and who really pushed for this against the initial inclinations of the administration. Obviously, it was a very good and hopeful thing, and I think that's all there is to it. But then at the same time, you have to say there are enormous problems and pitfalls ahead that certainly haven't been addressed, and whether in the end the vote will be seen as legitimate or not. For all of the good things one can say, to confuse this with an overall success for the project of invading Iraq would be, extremely premature thing to do, I think.
Hussein Ibish, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, one of the most powerful figures in Shia Islam in Iraq, right, has stated that he is not in favor of a theocracy modeled after the Iranian Islamic State.
That's what he says.
Right. But what, in your view, is the likelihood that that the majority Shiites, once they do take control of the government or a big part of it, will move towards establishing some kind of Islamic State allied with Iran?
Yeah, I really think that that's the most crucial question. It's certainly true that Grand Ayatollah Sistani, himself an Iranian, I might add, an interesting side fact, has said that he's not in favor of Vilayat al-Faqih in its most obvious form. In other words, he doesn't want the senior government figures to also be clerics, right? I mean, I think it may be that the Grand Ayatollah is, you know, not interested in a theocracy as in the Iranian-style theocracy. But I think it's absolutely clear he wants to have some sort of an Islamic Republic. People can be very moderate when they think they're on the brink of getting power, and that moderation does not always survive with their actual assumption of power.
Hussein Ibish, the United States has established 14 military bases across Iraq, and we can assume that those bases are going to be there for many decades ahead after all that investment.
Right.
What do you think will be the reaction of any future Iraqi government, and what's your projection for the course of the insurgency after this election?
Well, I think for sure the insurgency is not going to end. I mean, one of the silliest ideas that I hear in the American media and from U.S. officials, politicians, is the notion that, you know, the insurgents showed their weakness, that they did their worst, and it wasn't that bad, and that they, you know, only succeeded in killing 45 people, and they could not disrupt the election, and therefore chose the weakness of the insurgency. I think that if you believe that, you really, really must believe in the Easter Bunny. The hallmark of any serious guerrilla movement is to strike by surprise, when unexpected, and to withdraw quickly and live to fight another day. I mean, that is what, especially in urban guerrilla warfare, surprise is the essence of strategy. So I think it'll plainly go on, and I think it has been gaining strength. And, you know, it's not a contradiction if the government that we're trying to help set up gains strength and the insurgency gains strength at the same time. That is something that would make sense if Iraqi society is really becoming totally polarized or is on the way to becoming totally polarized. And I think we may be witnessing that. So the first thing I'd say is certainly the insurgency is going to go ahead and may well continue to gain strength in spite of the election and in spite of other political developments that may occur. The second thing is, I don't know. The extent to which, I mean, clearly the Pentagon was preparing for staying for the long haul in Iraq. I don't know the extent to which the Bush administration hasn't concluded that it walked into, you know, a minefield, that it really didn't know what it was doing, that it may be looking for a quick out if it can get it. And if that means not leaving permanent large U.S. military bases in Iraq, they might take it as long as the foreign and military policies of whatever government emerges is acceptable. And I think that's going to be the bottom line.
That was Hussein Ibish, vice chair of the Progressive Muslim Union. Visit the group's website at www.pmuna.org. While many political observers in the U.S. are trumpeting the success of Iraq's January 30th election as a first concrete step toward democracy and stability, others caution that the strength of the insurgency will not diminish and the war will likely continue. President Bush has cited his invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq that brought elections to those nations as an example of what he says is among his administration's top priorities: the democratic transformation of the Middle East and other authoritarian countries across the world. But people living in Arab and Persian Gulf nations had mixed reactions to the vote. Many are skeptical that a credible election can take place under a military occupation, while others are concerned that the divisions inside Iraq will be exacerbated by the vote and could lead to civil war. Still, some citizens living under one-party rule expressed hope that a democratic change would take hold in their countries and improve their own lives. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with historian and activist Howard Zinn, who examines the Iraq election by looking at the track record of establishing democracies under military occupations throughout history.
I'm sure a lot of Iraqis were glad to be able to vote, but to vote under conditions of a military occupation can hardly be called a free vote, can hardly be called a democratic process. And the crucial question in Iraq is, when will the occupation end? And when will the Iraqis be able to truly determine their own destiny, truly work out their own political future without the presence of an American army? Historically, we've had many, many instances in which elections have been held in other countries, but under the shadow of bayonets and machine guns. And when elections were held like that in other places, the United States did not look upon that as a democratic election, except, of course, when the machine guns and the bayonets were American. And as for this leading into the making of a constitution, we've also had a history of constitutions drafted while a country is being occupied by the United States, and those constitutions can hardly be called examples of democratic self-determination. I mean, the United States, back 100 years ago, when the United States invaded Cuba to drive the Spanish out and presumably to liberate the Cuban people, a constitution was created for the Cuban people. But the Constitution was created in the condition of American occupation and under American coercion, and the Constitution was one that was drafted to please the American occupiers and not to bring benefits to the people of Cuba. That Constitution gave the United States the right to send military forces into Cuba anytime it wanted. Some years later, after World War I, the United States invaded Haiti and occupied Haiti and drafted a constitution for Haiti. Those instances do not give us confidence when you consider that all of those votes taken, constitutions written, did not lead to democracy in those countries. They led to American control, and they led to dictatorship.
In a lot of the analysis that we're hearing, Howard Zinn, we hear U.S. officials quite often after this election talk about moving Iraq toward a stable democracy, and that will necessitate staying the course, quote unquote, that the U.S. can't cut and run at this time. Echoes of the peace with honor slogan that we heard during the Vietnam War years. You want to comment?
Well, you know, it's very interesting that you mentioned the Vietnam years, because we faced the same situation when we invaded Vietnam, and when it soon became evident that we were doing terrible damage to the people of Vietnam, and our troops were increasing year by year in Vietnam, and when they had reached a level after a couple of years of about 300,000-400,000, a number of Americans began to suggest that maybe the United States should withdraw from Vietnam, because we obviously were not doing the Vietnamese any good. We were bombing their villages. We were taking over their country. Huge numbers of people were being killed, and of course American GIs were being killed. And when some of us called for withdrawal, I had written a book and published in 1967, 2 years after the escalation of the war in Vietnam, called Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal. When we called for withdrawal, people said exactly the same things that are being said today. Oh, we mustn't cut and run. We must stay the course. Well, we did stay the course in Vietnam. After 1967, we stayed the course for six more years. And what was the result? The result was 2 million Vietnamese killed. The result was 58,000 American GIs coming home in body bags. That was the result of staying the course. We did not bring democracy to Vietnam by our military occupation, and we are not bringing democracy to Iraq by what we are doing there. And therefore, the most reasonable and moral thing to do is for the United States to end its occupation, to withdraw from Iraq as quickly as it possibly can, and let the Iraqis determine their own destiny with whatever difficulties they may have. But whatever difficulties they may have would not be as bad as what they are facing now with an American army barging into their homes, bombing them, killing people on such a scale that the British medical journal Lancet said that perhaps 100,000 civilians in Iraq had been killed in the course of this war. Yeah, Vietnam is an example for us. When we finally did leave Vietnam, all of those terrible consequences that were predicted did not come about. The only thing is that all those people had lost their lives, and Vietnam was a destroyed country by the time we left. And the reputation of the United States in the world had really declined precipitously, just as the reputation of the United States in the world today has gone way, way down because of the war in Iraq.
That was historian and activist Howard Zinn. His best-known work is titled A People's History of the United States. Learn more about his work by visiting the website howardzinn.org. Last week, serial killer and rapist Michael Ross came very close to being the first person executed in Connecticut and all of New England in 45 years. After spending 17 years on death row, Ross had dropped his voluntary appeals and convinced judges, lawyers, and psychiatrists that he was competent to choose death. But his execution has been postponed several times due to court intervention. The most recent delay in carrying out the death sentence occurred on January 31st after Ross's attorney, T.R. Paulding, filed motions in state and federal courts asking for a new hearing on his client's competency based on new and significant evidence. Death penalty abolitionists, who have been organizing against the execution for the past 3 months, gathered at a church near the maximum security prison where Ross was to receive a lethal injection at 2:01 a.m. on January 29th. They came to pray, sing, and listen to speakers who declared their view that state-sponsored taking of human life is wrong. One of the speakers was Art Laffin, a lifelong pacifist and activist with the Catholic Worker Movement and a member of Murder Victims' Families for Reconciliation. He explains his reaction to his brother's murder and why, despite his personal loss, he continues to believe that capital punishment is wrong. This interview was conducted shortly before Michael Ross's execution was postponed, when Laffin still expected the death sentence to be carried out.
My brother Paul was murdered 5 years ago by a mentally ill homeless man, and his name was Dennis Sutar. And had he been deemed competent to stand trial, he could have faced a death penalty. He was not competent to go to trial and was given basically a life prison sentence in a hospital for the criminally insane in Middletown, Connecticut.
What's the message that you're delivering here tonight on the eve of this execution?
Well, as a murder victim family member, my heart and prayers go out to the victims' families of Michael Ross. I know something of their pain. I do believe, however, that killing Michael Ross will not bring closure to this horrific nightmare that the victims' families have experienced. Killing the person who killed my brother will never bring my brother back. And the pain will always be there. And killing the person who kills only creates more victims. It increases the spiral of violence. There are more grieving families. And so we ask, you know, where will the cycle of violence end? You know, and the state in killing Michael Ross is, in fact, committing premeditated murder. It's homicide. And in light of my own faith belief, I believe God commands us not to kill. And so the state is violating that command tonight, early tomorrow morning, by killing Michael Ross. Michael Ross certainly deserves punishment. He deserves to be in a situation where he's no longer a threat to himself or other people. But we don't kill him, no matter how heinous the crime.
Have you talked at all with any of the victims' families in this case? Or have you been in any kind of contact, or have anybody in your group been in any kind of contact with them?
I have not. I don't know any of the family members. But if I had the chance to, I certainly would. Murder Victim Families for Human Rights is comprised of over 5,000 people across the United States who have had members of their family murdered and who actively oppose the death penalty. It's a group that believes that healing really comes from forgiveness and reconciliation, not vengeance and retribution. In this case, certainly, it's so clear that Michael Ross is guilty of these murders, but the state is, in fact, replicating what Michael Ross did by killing him. And so I just think it's a very sad moment for the state of Connecticut. After 45 years, why execute somebody now? Why not instead be the 13th state in the country that opposes the death penalty and join the European Union and most of the world community in outlawing the death penalty?
Was there ever any doubt in your mind, given your life and your beliefs and your activism, that when this horrible thing happened in your own family, that you would take this position? Did you ever feel like you didn't want to take the position that you now have? Was that a struggle for you at all or not?
Well, I felt so much pain and outrage about what happened to my brother, but I in my heart of hearts, I knew in light of my own faith that I couldn't support the killing of another person in revenge for what happened to my brother. And my mother and I both made public appeals to that effect, that we show mercy and compassion to Dennis Sutar, who killed my brother. And I have been in contact with members of the Sutar family and have offered my prayers to them. They're also grieving about what happened. There's pain on all sides. And the question I always ask is, what's going to promote healing for everybody involved? And certainly killing does not promote healing. It promotes more pain and more victims. And so I want to be about the process of reconciliation. And I believe that's the real way to healing.
That was Art Laffin of the group Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation. Visit the group's website at www.mvfr.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Toth. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Vanzari.